Okay, this is 14 August 1981, talking with John Finley at the IRSI meeting in Washington, D.C. Well, could I start off by asking what was your training in university? And I know that you didn't begin working in radio astronomy, but it's be very interesting to learn about your first contact with radio astronomy and how you observed the development of Ryle's group at Cambridge.
Yes, well, that's a question that covers an awful lot of time, but since you might just as well have the beginnings of my academic life, so to speak.
Right.
I am proud of the fact that I was an undergraduate in physics in Cambridge University, quite a bit prior to World War II, the dates you can get. I finished up with a degree in part two of the natural sciences tri-pass in
right.
physics, and then in 1937, July, was accepted by Lord Rutherford as a PhD student. He died two or three months later, so I am one of, there was no connection, I am one of the, I am one of the three or four final Rutherford students. However, I started my research work with Radcliffe, doing ionospheric research, and that lasted for only 2 years, because of course, for us, the war started in 1939.
Right.
Then, just before the outbreak of the war, I got in just a week or two before the outbreak of war. I went back to Cambridge and there for the first time met Martin Ryle, who had just arrived as a young research student. Radcliffe had got him from Oxford. Ryle had had a very distinguished undergraduate career at Oxford with Lindemann, was the professor, I believe,
mm-hmm.
yes.
I
believe
that's right,
they were. And the method of teaching, you'll shorten or you won't put all this in,
oh, no.
but I'm going to tell you what comes to my mind.
Yes, go right ahead.
The method of teaching at Oxford that Ryle described to him was so different from Cambridge, where our School of Physics, even in the part two, was 30, 40, 50 people. They tended to concentrate on the good ones. And Ryle, I think, for at least a year in his undergraduate work, was, so to speak, almost getting personal tuition.
I see.
He was being allowed to think and to bring up ideas.
I see.
I think it's interesting.
I've never heard that comment.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I'm pretty sure that's right, and of course it can be checked. Then, during the war, of course, both Ryle was very quickly put into TRE, that you know all about this,
right.
this bit of his life. He worked throughout the war in TRE, and I met him many times during the war. I worked there myself for, actually physically in TRE, for the first year or so of the war, and close to him, watching him do, first of all, antenna research, and then later, after I left physically TRE to go out to the what we call the Middle East, Ryle continued and, of course, did a lot of the radar countermeasures work,
right.
which was, of course, connected with the most highly sophisticated use of electronics and all that kind of thing.
And radiometry.
And radiometry. Yeah. And
now, what were you working on, though, briefly?
My war career was radar. I was, and particularly making it work, the usefulness of it. I was still associated with Radcliffe. At TRE, Radcliffe was head of a group of people who worked with Bomber Command, Fighter Command, with the Air Force,
mm-hmm.
helping to make radar work. This sounds silly, but radar didn't work. With due respect to Lovell, who built some of it, it didn't work, basically. And it needed scientists at the working level to make sure that it did work.
Mm-hmm.
It was, we called it post-design services,
right.
all silly names, but it was, that's all
so
it
what
was.
You're saying is that, in principle, it could work in the lab, but when
that's
you got
right.
in the field,
when
it didn't
in
work.
The field, and you couldn't set up a really good training program. You trained Air Force officers and people to maintain it and so on, but there were things that you simply hadn't trained for that.
Right.
Well, my war was spent doing that kind
I
of
see.
Work, first in the what I call the Middle East, call it North Africa, over that part of the continent, and then for about the four final years of the war, doing the same thing in what we call Southeast Asia, which was essentially India,
Burma.
Ceylon, as much of Burma as the Japanese hadn't got.
And now, why do you say with due respect to Lovell? Because he was on the other side of this...
No, no, Lovell was building it. I mean, due respect to the people like Lovell, who developed in TRE. He developed the H2S, I think.
Yes, I think that's
you
right.
You've got this from him. He developed the navigational aid in TRE, and part of his, some of his life story is, is the...
Well, tell me, once you had a working system in the lab and you needed 100 of them, were they built at TRE or were they built by a firm?
They were built by a company.
Yeah, right.
I was more in the ground radar end where the systems were built by a number of people. That is, a transmitter came from so-and-so and a receiver part came from so-and-so. And in fact, in India, we put the pieces together. That is, they were shipped to us.
Assembled the whole company.
And we assembled them and made them work and then sent them out. Well, I don't think my World War career was of much interest. The only...
Well, I just wanted the flavor of what you worked on, right.
The only comment I'll make on it just for fun. At the end of my career in India, I was in Southeast Asia serving... I wore a uniform, so I can say I served for Mountbatten, who was a great man.
Yes.
And I came back at the end of the German War, but... The Japanese War, as you remember, was not ended, and we were going to continue TRE operations in that theater for as long as Japan stayed in.
Right.
So my last task was to come back to England and put together a unit of TRE to move near Bombay.
Oh, I see.
Well, there's no great point in this except that one of the better radar people that actually went to Bombay was Graham Smith, he's never forgiven me for it. He said, you came to TRE looking healthy and told us what a wonderful thing it was to do, and they shipped him out to India, and of course within a few weeks the war had ended, and he was shipped back again. And Graham still says, I'll never forgive you for
that. Okay.
Well, the end of the war then was quite simple. I, of course, got back to Cambridge that year, that is, I'd already been elected a Fellow of Queen's during the war, so I had a job waiting for me. I went back and started that October, that is October 1945. And Ryle must have been as quick to get out as I was.
That time,
yes. He will have told you the month,
right.
But he was back there.
Just about exactly
the
that
Cavendish,
time.
Yeah. And Radcliffe was back, and then the Ryle group, Ryle knew precisely what he was doing.
And he and Von Berg
started putting together. I didn't know Von Berg before that. Putting together the first instrumentation.
Right, but now let me ask about yourself. Were you actually involved in dissertation research, which was interrupted by the war before, and so you had to sort of pick that up afterwards?
Yes, but you see, it was a long war. I was a PhD student before the war. I hold probably the world record in Cambridge. I think it was 13 years before I actually troubled to write a thesis.
Right.
As you know, we didn't in general, many people did not.
Well, in Martin Ryle never got around to writing.
Well, Jack Radcliffe never did.
Right.
Many people never troubled.
Right.
And the correct thing to do there, if you were staying, and Ryle should have done it, and I don't know whether he did, is just take an SCD.
Smith and papers.
You just wrap them up, put a red ribbon around them, pay in those days 10 guineas, and I suppose that's several hundred now, and pick up your SCD. Tommy Gold has just done this. Tommy never wrote a thesis.
Is that right?
He did, as a matter of fact. He wrote a very good thesis on the mechanism of hearing. He's an expert. And he either never submitted it, or in Tommy's inimitable fashion says, I'm not going to pay them for a PhD.
So you mean he's only recently become Dr. Gold?
He's recently become Dr. Gold.
I see.
And Ryle is.
Well, Ryle never
not
has.
A doctor.
No, Ryle is still not.
He's
no.
Has anybody given him an honorary degree?
I don't think so.
They should have done.
Not that I know of.
Cambridge won't, you see, probably.
Cambridge won't.
No, they won't, because he belongs there.
Yeah, right.
But Oxford should.
I agree, but
you
not
speak
that
to
I
somebody
know.
From Oxford. No, to say that is bad because he's a very distinguished.
Well, anyway,
okay, that's enough. Now that's almost an answer to your question. Beginning years in that Radcliffe group.
What was the setup?
The group belonged to Radcliffe. It was his old ionospheric group of many years standing. So there was an ionospheric contingent. Kenneth Weeks, who was mentioned in that talk, Kenneth Weeks and myself, Roy Piggott with the beard, was Appleton's assistant, and about that time Appleton came back to Cambridge. I can't remember the year of that. He was there after the war.
I don't know when he came. He left in 48.
That's right. That's 45 to Edinburgh. Yeah, I think he came back. Yeah, he came back to the second chair of physics in Cambridge. His name now, but we can get it. And for 3 years he was there. So Piggott was his assistant. And the only other person associated with that with him was Bynum, but Bynum was in...
But Appleton would be above Radcliffe.
Well, yes, except that the right-hand man of the whole lab was Radcliffe.
Yeah.
That is, Appleton...
Was more involved in administration.
Yes, well, he had the, what we call it, the... I've forgotten the name of the professorship. A freewheeling professorship. Mm-hmm. He didn't have to run anything.
I see.
And he did concentrate on research, and I don't know what else he did. But the ionospheric group was quite a strong group. Bracewell was in the ionospheric group.
Yes, that's right.
Ron was there. I think he's the only one who went into radio astronomy. Sid Bohill, people of that kind. Radke had a strong group. And in parallel, Ryle, starting as though he were a research student, built up a strong radio astronomy group,
right.
And you've got most of their names.
Yes. Sure. But now... I'd be interested if you can remember at that time Radcliffe's degree of enthusiasm or support about radio astronomy. I mean,
yeah. I can answer that in two ways. First of all, you can never, as you know, you've met Radcliffe, you can't judge his enthusiasm. He's the most controlled man I've ever met. He could never understand me, for example.
Or Lyle, I suppose.
Yes. Except, of course, I was also an assistant professor. You see, you can't describe the student relationship in those terms. When I'm teaching the Cavendish, I am, in fact, essentially his equal.
Right, however, which was a demonstrator.
A demonstrator. Now, he used to ask me to meet with him once a week to see how my research was going. And he, of course, being Radcliffe, picked 9 o'clock on Monday morning.
Right.
Well, Findlay always turned up at 7 minutes after nine on Monday morning. There was poor Jack sitting at his desk, wondering why I was late. And every time, he could never get it.
Yeah.
Anyhow, come back. But he supported Ryle in two, very noticeable ways. First of all, on a very practical level, we all, as a group, we worked together, and I and many others worked on practical matters for Ryle's group. Ryle had problems. His research station started on what we call the old rifle range, and so he was building his antennas there. That's where we had one of our little ionospheric research hubs, and so we had to extend our operations, get permission for power and telephone and persuaders.
And people like you participated in this.
And I did that, yes. Yeah. I mean, I was by this time over 30, and I was perfectly competent to manage some affairs for Ryle. A very minor point, but we had a lot of fun. Immediately after the war, I was the person to set going and physically collect surplus equipment from all over the country. Ryle knew where. We knew where it was in the establishment.
Right.
We simply took a truck. Make a telephone call and took the truck.
Ryle has told me that whole story. Where they come back with the Hertzbergs.
Bring back the oscilloscopes.
Right.
They lasted for years. All sorts of electronic equipment. And that was the spirit at that time. Now, the other significant point, which I'm sure Radcliffe was responsible for, he saw to it, I'm not sure that he did it. He must have done, I think. Who was the professor at this time? It was Bragg, wasn't it?
The Cavendish Professor Bragg.
Yes, all my time it was Bragg. I'm sure it was Radcliffe. Radcliffe saw to it that Ryle was never loaded with any teaching at all.
Mm.
And to earn one's keep, he wouldn't have been to begin with because he had a source of money from ICMI or something. He had a source of...
Separate research
money. Mm-hmm. But they very soon appointed him a lecturer, that is, one from the demonstrator level, but never gave him a teaching note. Now that, I think, is a very significant point.
Right.
I think it shows that if it was Radcliffe, at any rate, it shows that Cavendish were doing that thing which I think the British do very well. They pick somebody who's good, and they put their money on it.
Yeah.
And I think they did that at Oxford when they taught Lyell, and I think Cambridge did it again.
Yeah.
And
what about the administrative side of things? Was it the same way there, that Radcliffe was taking a load off of Radcliffe? This might be more relevant to later years, perhaps.
I don't think Lyell had to do anything much, you see. He's probably, you know how Cambridge, how you collected people to do research with you or for you. Each year, the prize undergraduate students, those who get first class degrees in part two, are automatically given financial support from the government in that time, I think it's still true, and they are up for grabs.
Right.
And if you were one and you looked around the possible professors and you saw Lyell, you'd almost certainly.
Yep.
And they did. And so Lyell could pick what he wanted. Outsiders were not coming to him much at that time from other places, but he had a ready-made supply, again, which I'm sure Radcliffe helped. And Radcliffe being
well, he had a considerable reputation also.
Yes, and he knew these undergraduates, you see, so he would, all he would say is, Martin.
That's right, because he did a lot of teaching.
That's right.
We haven't talked about that yet. Yeah. But
and he's also an examiner, you see. I mean, he was into the business of knowing how good people were.
Excuse me.
Yep.
Well, but what about the matter of getting governmental support, this kind of administrative thing? I mean, was that pretty much off Ryle's shoulders also?
Yes. The way, again, the way the Cavendish was operating, you know, with very little money, the cost
the
of
old
Ryle's
Rutherford
operation
tradition.
Were measured in hundreds of pounds only.
Right.
And in the same way that DSIR, Department of Scientific and Industrial Research, gave me £300 a year when I became a student because I got a first class degree, they gave to, I think, directly to the Cavendish, though it may have been pointed to Radcliffe and then subsequently to Ryle, support for the costs of research.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, you've read about the amounts of money that Ryle would be spending in those early days. They were very small.
Right.
He was using the local ironworker to make very simple antennas. Much of the stuff was made.
All the surplus equipment.
Yes, and all the surplus equipment was there. Equipment, as you know, was quite simple. Cambridge shops were good. You can still see him. You've been in the Cavendish. You've seen his early phase switch.
Mm-hmm.
It's there. That was made in the shops of
right.
the Cavendish. My guess would be £1,000 a year would keep Lyell happy.
Yep.
And I believe he didn't have to ask for it. I'm as sure as can be, because after all, my ionospheric research was supported in the same way. I never asked for any money for anybody for the 7 years I was
Radcliffe
there.
Took care of it all.
You just got equipment.
Yep.
You know. Now, Lyell would be spending more than I was, because
his group.
So there, that was the Cambridge University way. One was relieved of those responsibilities.
Does this hold true right until the late 50s? I mean, when Ryle became a professor, or are you only talking about the early years now?
I have to stop, you see, at 1952.
That's when you left.
Yeah. And by then, he had not built. He had not got into any of the instrument building, even the 1 mile telescope, even the larger
4C aerial.
Yeah, that's right.
The Lord's Bridge didn't come along until 55,
that's right.
56.
So that's a good marker to put on it. I'm speaking of the days before Lord's Bridge.
The Grange Road site.
That's right, the Grange Road operation alone, and you could check with any of the others.
Right.
I don't think he had to ask for a penny.
Yeah. Okay.
I think it was all. That's nice, isn't it?
Well,
now that he must have done afterwards.
Yeah.
He must have been the fundraiser, the fund requester.
Right. Now, what about? Can you remember Radcliffe's attitude towards radio astronomy intellectually? You might say. I mean, was he always probing with questions about? Radio astronomy itself, or did he just sort of let Ryle run with the whole thing and then he worry only about the ionosphere?
I think he just let Ryle run with it. I would be sure that he understood and followed every word that was being done. But I really believe he let Ryle mm-hmm. very free. I was going to suggest he's here. Spend 10 or 15 minutes with Henry Booker if you haven't done so.
No, I haven't.
Henry was our theoretician in the ionospheric group, that is, he and Radcliffe were side by side. And Henry left in about 1950.
Mm-hmm.
But he is older than I am, and he and Ratcliffe were very much equal intellectually, and he might ask him about Jack Ratcliffe in
I'll
this respect. Henry Booker. He's
I have seen him.
You've seen him. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Now, while we're on the subject of Ratcliffe, one final question would be his famous lectures. Could you tell me about him as a teacher and how you think that influenced the Cavendish radio group, radio astronomy group, I should say?
Yeah, and I'm very happy to answer that one, Woody. That sounds a bit formal, but it's true. The first lecture I went to in the Cavendish as an undergraduate was Jack Ratcliffe when I was 19. And he stands out still as being probably the best teacher of physics at the undergraduate level and all the way up that I've ever met. He was so good that when I became a supervisor and tried to teach people afterwards, privately as they do in Cambridge, I realized how bad he was.